I don't know if I'm terrified, but I'm certainly nervous. I was sitting there thinking, you know, give me 7 people, I can do a really good chair. You know, give me 25 people, and I can do a pretty good chair. But I don't know how many people are here. You know, but it's a little more daunting. Even though I know some of the faces here, it's just the sheer volume of people that is a bit overwhelming. So I'll just get that out. I mean, I've told myself that, you know, I don't need to impress anyone, I don't need to make you laugh, I don't need to do any of those things. I really only need to tell you, you know, how I got here and why I keep coming here, and what NA has done for me. I just really need to give you the facts, and tell you about some of the feelings, of course. I was thinking, in a way, it's quite a good idea just to start where you are, you know, and I've had a stressful couple of weeks. I've just moved house. I moved in with the woman that I've been seeing for 2 years, who I love very much, and it's the most fantastic relationship I've had in my life, let alone in my recovery. And we've brought together 5 children. I have 3 boys, she has 2. And so it's a sort of social experiment in the name of love and other things. But it's been massive. I can't really downplay it. I can feel it in my body. You know, I can feel the tension and the stress that I've been through in the last month, 6 weeks. And but here's the thing, you know, I haven't had to use through that. I haven't had to use today. Let's just keep it in the day. You know, I've not had the best day. You know, whenever I have to do a chair, it's just bizarre, but I'm never in a fantastic kind of space when I have to do a chair. I don't know what that's about. I always think, you know, that I'll be on top of the world and just gung-ho and, you know, evangelical and just selling the message. And it's my HP sense of humor, but, you know, I haven't been in the... But do you know what? It doesn't matter, though. The message isn't that we come along and we have to tell everyone, we have to convince everyone that everything is fantastic all the time. The only message is that, you know, every day is what it is and we don't use. You know, that is it. It doesn't matter. There are no excuses. I'm sure other people can identify. I mean, I used, not just when I was feeling really down and feeling like crap. I used when I was feeling exhilarated and fantastic. And I mean, I couldn't handle that either. You see, I couldn't handle that end of the spectrum either. So it's not just about the sort of the dark feelings. It's about all feelings. And I'm sort of glad to be here. I would, like Sarah said, and I loved what Sarah said, it really helped to ground me. I would prefer to be on that side of whatever the table. I always try to kind of seize the opportunity to, as it were, testify, you know, to kind of, I owe this fellowship my story, my example that it can work, you know. It doesn't work for everyone, but it has worked for me a day at a time. And it's worked for a lot of people that I know. And, you know, Sarah spoke to, you know, had some words for the newcomer. I want you know, it's really important for me to remember those who are in early days who may be as sort of bemused and baffled by all this as I was. You know, I need to remember how I felt when I came in, I was terrified of you know what I was really terrified of was joining in. You know, I don't think we addicts are naturally very good at joining in. We're sort of born loners, and I was very alone, even in company. I was alone in my head a lot of the time. And so I found it very daunting joining this thing, and sorry, I just need to catch my breath and remember what I'm doing sitting here. I'm 48 years old. I just turned 48 last week, Saturday, and I came into this fellowship when I was 24, and you know, I guess I had had enough at 24. Thank God. You know, I addiction for me, you know, I don't know whether addicts are born or made. And I don't know whether addiction is a disease or just a survival mechanism. I just don't know, and I don't think it's really necessary to debate it. What I know is that I was a very, you know, like Sarah said, I think she put it beautifully, you know, she wanted to be someone else, somewhere else, at another time. I thought that was absolutely on the money, you know. My memory of my early years is of just feeling completely separate from not just sort of other kids and other human beings, but from my own family. I felt like I didn't really even belong there. I'm not sure I felt like I belonged anywhere. I didn't feel like I belonged in school. And you know, addiction for me, I think, manifested itself at a very early age, and it was a way of sort of disappearing, of retreating into myself, and of not feeling. I characterize addiction as kind of repetitive action that enables me not to feel what I should be feeling, and that really can apply to a wide range of behaviors. I know that I was obsessive and compulsive and repetitive and kind of monomaniacal from as far back as I can recall, you know, collecting things, you know, storing things, losing myself in fantasy. It's a word I hear a lot in the fellowship, and I always identify it with. Fantasy maybe was my first drug. You know, just not really being present, you know, not really being here in the world in the present, because I didn't feel safe here in the present in the world. It was safer for me to retreat some sort of part of my mind that I had sort of split off, if you like. And so that I believe, you know, for me, that was my, probably my first addiction. You know, I remember being at the back of the class, always in a daydream, and staring out the window. And, you know, what I think I can say about myself as a kid is that I didn't like myself very much. I was, for whatever reasons, ashamed of myself. And I felt like I was a skinny, weak kid. I just wasn't happy in my own skin, and I don't know whether that's to do with addiction. I don't know where that came from. I don't know, you know, I don't know how much my family of origin had to do with it. I do believe that I didn't get things that I think kids need. But that's just for me. I mean, it doesn't really matter. But I feel like, you know, something we all have in common, in a sense, is that we didn't experience love when we should have experienced it, and from a variety of sources, not just from our parents. And as time's gone on in my recovery, I've been able to understand, you know, what it was that my parents didn't have to give. You know, they didn't really have it to give, and in a sense, it wasn't really their fault. You know, if you're not given something, then you don't have it to pass on. And I don't think my parents really had it to pass on to me. I mean, I could have done a lot worse. You know, I had a, you know, in many ways, you know, privileged, comfortable upbringing, but I didn't like myself, and I was a pretty melancholy little soul, you know. And I know that when I first got a mood-altering substance into my bloodstream, it just it made a hell of a difference to how I felt about Barney and how I felt about the outside world. You know, I remember hearing a chair when I was very early in recovery that made a big impact on me. It was a guy who'd been around in America for years and years, and he put it very well. He kind of turned it around and he said, you know, when I drank, I didn't change, but the world changed. Now, in a sense, that's wrong. You know, I did change when I drank. But I thought he put it very well, because for him, what happened was he drank, and slowly, the world started to look like a different place. You know, the world that had 5 minutes, 10 minutes before looked hostile and frightening and full of aggressive people who didn't like him, suddenly started to look like a warm, friendly place where everybody was his best friend. And I thought, yes, that's, you know, that's why I drank and used, because it changed my picture of the universe. And I preferred that picture, obviously. It was a happier place for me to be in. You know, and I, so, you know, alcohol was my first experience of, you know, getting out of my head. I mean, you know, we use that expression, you know, for a very good reason. I needed to get out of my head. My head was an extremely uncomfortable, anxious place to be, and I wanted to get out of it. And that's all my using was about, getting out of my head, literally. So alcohol got me out of my head, and also, you know, very quickly got me into the loo, you know, throwing up. And I remember that very well. So it was all tied in, that first experience. You know, my using story is a classic progression. There's nothing remarkable about it. You know, I in terms of illicit chemicals, I moved from, you know, from what we used to call dope and grass, marijuana and grass, through speed, psychedelics, cocaine, to eventually opiates. I never set out to become a drug addict. You know, at the age of 10, 11, if you'd asked me, you know, do you think you're going to be a drug addict, a heroin addict? It was the furthest thing from my mind. The idea of heroin addicts, heroin addict was like the bogeyman, was this scary figure that my parents had sort of painted this picture of. I was really freaked out by the idea of heroin addicts. So the idea that, you know, in my late teens, I would be allowing my best mate to stick a needle in my arm was, I mean, even now I think it's extraordinary. I don't know why I did it. Do you know? I don't know. I knew what happened to people who did that, but I still went ahead and did it. I guess because I didn't care enough about myself or rate my chances at succeeding in life maybe that highly. You know, what I would say about adolescence, which was a really confusing strange experience for me, was that I think what happened to me was that I gradually moved further and further away from the truth of who I was. I can probably put that a bit better. I didn't really know who I was. And instead of having the conviction inside that it was okay to be me, whatever that meant, in the body that, you know, life gave me, with the talents and attributes that life gave me or didn't give me, it wasn't enough. It wasn't good enough. And without realizing it, what I started to do was to try to become something else, you know. And the longer that went on, I think the further I got away from the real me. So that by the time I came into this fellowship, I had no idea who I was. I was so far away from me. You know, in a sense, I had put on so many masks over the course of those years. trying to get you to like me, basically trying to get people to think I was cool. I mean, that, you know, it's really as simple as that. Being me, it's funny, like before the chat, my dear friend Tollis, who I've been in recovery with for years and years and shared recovery with, just said, you know, all you have to do is be you up there. Well, you know, that can be a tall order, you know, just be you. Well, who am I? You know, what is me? You know, I don't, you know, I didn't know what I was. All I knew was that whatever it wasn't good enough. It wasn't enough. You know, I was not enough. But somehow when I put, you know, when I got stoned, you know, somehow it was okay. It was okay to be me. That's all I knew. And I could almost believe that I was these things that I pretended to be. You know, it was almost like a conjuring trick. I could believe it. And I could lie without, I could say that I'd done things I hadn't done without caring whether they were true or not. I think the gift that drugs gave me, and they were a gift, it was a solution for me. Drugs were a solution for me to the kind of agony I felt being in my own skin. Drugs enabled me just not to really care. I just didn't care. I didn't care what I was going to do tomorrow. I didn't care whether I was going to get a job or not, or ever make enough money to live. I didn't care whether I had any clean clothes in the morning. I didn't even care that nobody really knew me very well. Because I just drifted away into a pleasant state of sort of indifference, really. And boy, I loved that, you know. And the more I experienced that, the more I needed it. I didn't just want it, I needed it. And I suppose that's the difference between, you know, a recreational drug user and us, you know. I needed it. Fuck, I needed it, you know. Once I discovered that magic, that magical thing that could just stop the world feeling so overwhelming and oppressive and confusing and hard to understand, and hard to understand people's expressions and what they were saying, and you know, and hard to know where you stood with people. Did people really like me? I don't know. I don't, you know, just fuck it, just get loaded, and it doesn't really matter. And I can't really tell you why it doesn't really matter when you're loaded. It just doesn't. Everything just stops mattering. Until eventually, of course, you know, the thing snowballs into a massive problem of its own, and then we, you know, then we're faced with a very stark choice. But it, you know, my progression, I suppose, was quite rapid. I mean, I once I discovered opiates in particular and coke. And it doesn't really, fuck, it doesn't matter what drugs we do. You know, different drugs do different things to different people. I really don't think it matters. But for me, you know, it was opiates, and it was coke, and it was needles, and I was very obsessive, and it was very scary, and it took me to some places that, frankly, I didn't expect to go. I didn't expect to go, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't stop myself going to those places. You know, the definition of an addict in our literature, you know, is someone whose life and thinking are centered in drugs and the getting and using of more drugs, you know. And it's very clear to me that most of us cross a line where you might say, well, I use on Fridays or Saturdays and maybe Wednesdays, you know. And you cross a line where basically you're, you know, nothing comes before drugs. You can't do anything before you score. I couldn't do this. I couldn't go to a party. I couldn't meet people. I couldn't do anything until I got the drugs. And then eventually I wasn't doing any of those things anyway because I was using just to use. And I wasn't using for any other reason than it was like I just a loop. You know, I've been coming to these meetings clean for you know, for a good few years, and so this stuff for me is, you know, it's quite a long time ago. Sometimes the memories are a bit vague, but I tell you what, if I ever think about, if I sort of thought about I don't know, going out and having a line of Coke tonight or something. If I just think about that, the idea that I, at whatever, 23 something years clean, could go out and, I mean, my palms start sort of moistening when I just think about a line of Coke. Not that I want to do it, but just the thought of what that would set in motion. You know, the idea, just I know in every cell in my body what would happen if I did that. You know, that I would be off to, I'd just be off with it within probably minutes. You know, I cannot imagine that it wouldn't end up 3 a.m. with me in a with a needle in my arm somewhere. So I just sort of, thank God I got step one pretty solidly early on. You know, I just knew that there was no way I was ever going to be able to safely or in a controlled way use drugs. My using got me, basically got me to California. That was my big geographical one of many, but that was the ultimate one. I went to California, of all places, thinking somehow, what, I'd be able to sort of avoid drugs in Los Angeles. You know, that was really clever, you know. I mean, I think I lasted about 2 weeks. Anyway, that's where I rock bottomed. And I remember, you know, I was very moved by Sarah's memory. You know, it's like we all have, maybe it's one, maybe it's two or three, memories, really vivid, visceral memories of like being at the fucking bottom, being at the absolute bottom and in total despair. And I hit certainly one of those, the one that changed my life, if you like, in Los Angeles. And it was enough for me. I just felt so desperate. I reached that point where I couldn't live with drugs anymore, but I couldn't live without them either. You know, it was that neither nor. I couldn't make this work. You know, I was able to stop now and then, but I couldn't get rid of the craving inside that would come back. And I remember thinking, I might physically be able to stop using for today, but how am I ever going to kind of rip that sort of serpent of craving out of my head? It's never going to go. It doesn't matter where I go. I could go to the North Pole, but I can't remove that from myself. I remember thinking, you know, this is really serious. You know, I don't know what I can do about this. I don't want to use anymore. And anyway, and that was really when the white flag went up. And cut a long story short, I went to my first meeting. Funny enough, I was in Los Angeles about a year ago, and I was driving along this street, and I saw the building where I had gone to my first meeting. And the state that I'd been, I never remembered where it was, and it was, I don't know, it just sort of brought everything full circle. I saw it, and I, you know, that's where it started, and that's why I'm alive. That's why I'm alive today, because of that. It was a church, you know, all I can really, you know, my memory of that first meeting obviously is pretty kind of vague, but I do know that I heard, for the first time in my life, I heard other human beings talk about how I felt inside. I don't think I had ever experienced that. I'd never really identified or shared with any other human being about what was really going on inside me. So I never knew. I never knew how other people felt. I never knew how other addicts felt. I just used with them, and we just talked shit, you know, and listened to music and lied to each other and pretended to be things that we weren't, you know. So how did I know how they were really feeling, how scared and desperate they were? You know, I had no idea, you know. But here were people talking about not just the way they used and why they used and what drugs did for them, but the feelings they'd had before they'd ever picked up a drug that caused them to pick up drugs and alcohol in the first place. And I just thought, you know, I think this is home. I think this is the right place for me. I think I belong here. And that was, that would have been, I'm getting, that would have been about June 1983. And, you know, I, again, to sort of speed the story up, I came back to London, and the fellowship was very, very small. I think there were about 8 meetings a week, and I can't remember whether there was a Trafalgar Square meeting on a Monday night, and I remember coming to that. I don't remember that was, yeah, anyway, whether that was going then or not, I do remember it. And so just being here brings back, you know, sort of real memories for me. I, you know, I think the biggest word for me, in terms of early recovery, is surrender. You know, it's, I love the slogan, surrender to win, because I think it's the hardest thing in the world to surrender, to really let go of the delusion that, you know, I'll be able to control my using, but also just to sort of let go of the need to feel that somehow I've got to have all the answers, you know, that I should be able to sort this out by myself, you know, being a kind of natural lone wolf type. You know, I had that philosophy in my head that you should be self-sufficient, you should be like some, you know, it just wasn't cool really to ask for help or join in or become part of something bigger than you. It just was so uncool really, and yet I kind of realized that my life depended on it. You know, it was either, it was like either continue trying to be cool real unsuccessfully, or you know, or actually maybe survive and live, you know. And I kind of, I sort of, anyway, I mean, for me it was that choice, as uncomfortable as I found it, to go to meetings, to sit there at the back, not open my mouth, look at all of you hugging each other. And you know, it didn't occur to me, I mean, this is how sort of just myopically self-centered we are, it didn't occur to me that anyone had come in feeling like I did. Do you know, I think you see everybody like hugging, you think, well, they were always like that, they were always popular in school and everyone always loved them, so maybe I don't even belong here, you know, instead of thinking, well, you know, these are junkies, for Christ's sake. I don't suppose they were hugging each other, you know, up the dilly, you know, when they were scoring, you know, so but I, you know, it was difficult for me, it was really difficult. I felt so on, I mean, it was so easy for me to exclude myself, you know, to find excuses, to leave early, to and yet I knew I had to keep coming back. And I suppose the biggest moment for me, I mean, I was so consumed with just self-conscious, so self-conscious. You know, I hear people say it's like the agony, you know, at the end of a meeting, you know, you work up the courage to talk to somebody, and then you're talking to them, but you're not really listening to what they're saying because all you're thinking about is what you're going to say next. You know, or that just nightmare of like, oh, just being trapped in this skull and it being so important what people think of you. And you know, I'm a message really to anyone new, it doesn't matter, it doesn't. And I would urge anyone, however long clean, just to share, to open your mouth. It's the biggest, I think it's the single biggest like bridge to feeling a part of this thing. It, as terrifying as it is, you know, I had to learn to just open my mouth and just, it's like jumping into the deep end. You know, fuck what came out. It doesn't matter what comes out. You know, it doesn't matter. We're all insane here anyway. So it just does not matter. You know, no one's judging you. No one's judging you. And you know, we all only care that you make it. We want you to make it. We want everyone to make it. And I, you know, I think that's so important to have that faith, to trust that. We have to trust this thing, you know, because we're not very trusting people. I'm not by nature a very trusting person, you know, and I'm suspicious and, you know, they really like me. They really want me here. Can't they see that I'm a schmuck, you know? They're going to see, you know, if I open my mouth, they're going to see. You know, if you're honest, you know, you only invite love. You know, if you are honest and you just tell it like it is and let people see you as you really are, you will only invite love to come towards you. I really believe that. And like Tolle says, you only need to be you. That is the great secret of life for me, is the only person you need to be is you. It is enough to be you. You know, the daily thing for me is, you know, if I can just accept myself as I am today, you know, warts and all, you know, that is the priceless gift. It doesn't matter where I'm living, what I'm driving, who I'm dating, what my job is, what clothes I'm wearing. It doesn't matter. Because the real beauty of a person's soul is invisible and unmeasurable and immaterial. And it's just who they are and how they express themselves and how they smile and how they give of themselves, you know. But of course, I don't know the first fuck about any of that. When I came in, I was completely paranoid and self-conscious. But, you know, it doesn't matter. What happened was I kept coming back. You know, all I've done for 23 years is not pick up the first drug one day at a time and continue coming to meetings regularly. You know, I mean, I could just end the chair there. I could just say, that's it. That's it. Everything else has followed. The step work, the relationships, the sponsor, the sponsees, the commitments. You know, everything else has followed as a consequence of just those two things. You know, if you keep coming, even if you're using, keep going to meetings. You know, the penny sometimes doesn't drop for years. I don't know why. Some people come in at 18 and get it straight away. Some people are still coming at 73 and they still don't get it. They still haven't got it. I don't know why. I can't tell you why. It's a mystery, you know. But I have seen people struggle for years and then one day the penny has dropped. And it's an amazing thing to see, to behold. It's almost like a physical thing. You can see it in someone when they've given up the fight. And it comes back to that idea of surrendering. You know, when you really surrender and you really take step one and you get out of the ring with this thing that is always going to beat the crap out of you. You know, that's how it's always going to win. You are never going to win. You know, when you get out of the ring and you just put down the boxing gloves, you know, it's a fantastic thing. It doesn't need to be a struggle. It doesn't need to be a daily, I'm going to fucking beat this thing. You know, I'm sure other people will identify this. I still have people, years into recovery, people saying to me, you must be so strong, you know, to have beaten this thing, you know. And I just, it's so hard to explain that it's got nothing to do with strength. Nothing to do with strength at all. You know, it's the opposite of strength. You know, admitting that my strength had run out. I didn't have any more willpower. You know, you must have such willpower. No, I had willpower to go to the ends of the earth to score. But my willpower ran out. And it's not willpower that brings me here. It really isn't. It's not willpower that stops me using. A power greater than myself stops me using a day at a time and gets my ass here. I can't explain it. I know that because I'm sure as hell not doing it. I surrendered to this thing and it has carried me. And how can I best define this thing? You know, I don't know what it is. I have problems with the word God. And I don't know what it means. It's shorthand for, you know, a higher power, a power greater than me. All I knew was I needed something bigger than Barney because Barney could not stay clean, could not keep himself clean, and he never will be able to. And that's what I surrendered to. And I found it, if you like, embodied in these rooms, in us, a spirit, something that's here that just happens when we get together, that's bigger than me. And when I come into a meeting, I can feel like shit, but I can tell you what, if I listen and I give myself to the meeting, and if I maybe open my mouth and I talk and I join in with this thing that's frightening and scary, and, you know, I tell you what, I never leave without feeling in some way transformed. You know, I feel better. I just feel better. I can't tell you why, but I think it's just that I've let something in that wasn't there when I came into the meeting, and it is a spirit, and it is. I can call it love, but I call it, you know, it doesn't really matter. It's what we collectively share and do with you. The point about recovery for me is that I can't do it on my own, and I don't need to do it on my own. That's the great message, you know, that we get to share our lives with others. We're not alone anymore. Every day, most every day, I'm on the phone to someone, a mate in recovery, or a mate-ess in recovery, just you know, talking about how it is, how life is, you know, and it's fucking hard, is what I've found. You know, I, you know, for years had this idea that one day, you know, when I got everything, I got all the appurtenances, you know, the job, the girlfriend, the car, you know, everything we know, all those sort of illusions in a way, that then I'd hit this lovely plateau where, you know, I'd never have any problems again. And unfortunately, I haven't hit it yet. You know, I don't mean to be depressing, but I haven't found it yet. I find every day is basically, my dad says life is just one damn thing after another, and then you die, you know. And it just, apparently that's what it is. I just don't, I, you know, every day is one damn thing after another, and then I go to bed. You know, and I've fought that for years. It shouldn't be like that. It shouldn't be difficult. Well, I finally, you know, just come to the conclusion that it just is. It just is. That's what it's like. It's never not going to be difficult. But there's a way of looking at that, which is just saying, it's all right. Let's just try and go with the flow. You know, let's just try and take it in our stride and not make such a bloody drama out of everything, you know. Anyway. I've got to wind up. You know, there I was terrified of having to speak for 40 minutes, and then I get the 5-minute thing. You know, I just want to endorse it. So I said, you know, I did work the steps with a sponsor a long time ago. The steps are embodied in the way I live my life. And they are the principles that I live by. You know, primarily honesty. So everything starts with that. If you can be honest enough to say that I'm defeated as a drug addict, my career as a drug addict is over, I can't do it anymore. That is the first fantastic, honest statement that you can make. I'm finished as a career addict. Right? And you know, if you can start with that honest statement, you never need to be dishonest again. You know, it took me a while to figure out what I really felt about stuff, you know, and still for me, the struggle can be, what am I really feeling? What am I really feeling about this situation? I don't know. I'm not sure yet. I need to talk about it. I need to know what this feeling is. And sometimes it's 3 or 4 feelings. And it's complicated. You know, it's not simple. It's not black or white, good or bad. But I need to be able to articulate what goes on in here and here. I need to be able to verbalize it and write it down and look at it. And when I can do that, I'm at peace with myself. You know, so I just, you know, it saved my life. It's given me a life. I have a life. I have 3 fantastic kids. I have a woman I love. I work productively. I make enough money. I have adventures. I go interesting places. I trust that there's going to be enough for me. And I trust that I am enough. You know, I am enough today. And that is the ultimate gift that Narcotics Anonymous has given me. Thank you.